Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Bolsheviks and Blue Dogs square off as the last semblance of sane moderates fight valiantly, but ultimately in vain, for the soul of the Democrat Party. We cover reparations and racist, the socialist and psychic forces. Buckle up for another crazy Democratic debate stage. This is Charlie Kirk, host of the Charlie Kirk Show. One second, I'm going to ask you to do something. Please press subscribe, give us that five-star rating, leave us a review. Buckle up, we got a full show for you. Did you know that most break-ins happen between 6 a.m. and 6 p.m.? This is so important, everybody. In the middle of the day. That means when you aren't there. According to the FBI, the average loss in a burglary is over $2,000. This can be really hard to recover from. And what's crazy is that only 1 in 5 homes have home security, maybe because most companies really don't make it easy. I could tell you, my property, the places I care about, are protected by Simply Safe. Most of these security systems are so confusing, hard to set up, long wait times. Simply Safe is the best. They made it so easy for me. I call them up. They set it up. They have a security expert ready and able to help you out. That's why Simply Safe is my top choice. Hands down, Simply Safe protects your entire home, every window, room, and door, with 24/7 monitoring just for a fraction of the cost. I'll tell you why. Their police dispatch is up in 3.5 times faster because they use video verification. It's designed to blend right into your home. No wires, no drilling. It's won a ton of awards from CNET to New York Times Wirecutter. Prices are always fair and honest. It protects my property. It should protect yours as well. Visit simplysafe.com/Charlie. You get free shipping and a 60-day risk-free trial. You've got nothing to lose. Go now and be sure you go to simplysafe.com/Charlie so they know our show sent you. That's simplysafe.com/Charlie. Go do it now. What's up, everybody? Welcome to this episode of the Charlie Kirk Show. I watched the Democrat debates, so you didn't have to. I hope you had a wonderful night at home doing something other than watching the Democrat presidential debates. I predicted that it would be a Marxist circus. That's right, a Marxist circus. And I can say I was half right. I do think that this was, you know, I'm a huge Star Wars fan. So if the first episode of the Democrat debates was a Marxist hope, I would have to say the second episode of the Democrat debates would be the moderates strike back. So in this episode of the Democrat debate, I have to say there was more actual policy discussion in this debate than I'm used to. I have to give fake news CNN Jake Tapper some credit. He actually kept the pace going pretty good, I have to say. You know, there was really good spirit and really good back and forth and actual policy discussion. But here's the deeper thought of what was really going on here. And this is the second or third level down, the stuff that we at the Charlie Kirk Show examine and that we're going to give you that no other program, no other show is going to give you, which is this entire Democrat debate essentially is two separate and two totally distinct philosophies of how the Democrats are going to react to their failure to win the 2016 election. This entire debate was about how do they try to proceed as a Democrat party. And so here's the frame. It's the Blue Dogs versus the Bolsheviks. Blue Dog obviously means Blue Dog Democrat, which essentially is another way to say a moderate Democrat, a Democrat that usually comes from generally moderate districts, a lot of union workers, a lot of Catholics, a lot of people that work with their hands. These are the Reagan Democrats. This is the base, the traditional base of the Democrat Party. And of course, now you have the Bolsheviks, which is a Russian term, of course, which essentially means Russian revolutionary, Russian communist, Marxist revolutionary, which, of course, Bernie Sanders and Senator Warren kind of falls into more of that camp. And in this debate in particular, you had John Delaney, former congressman from Maryland. You had Governor Bullock from Montana. You had Governor Hickenlooper. And you had Pete Buttigieg, who kind of was in the middle between the moderates and the extremists. He's kind of in between, somewhere between Blue Dog and Bolsheviks. You can put Buttigieg kind of right in the middle. You also had Congressman Tim Ryan, of course, from Ohio, and who was more in the Blue Dog Democrat category totally and completely. And so John Delaney kind of set the terms of the entire debate. John Delaney set the terms for the entire debate in his opening statement by essentially saying we cannot become a party of unrealistic promises. And he was actually saying some stuff that when he said it, I didn't hate it. Like, he actually said some stuff as he said it where he said we have to come up with the right balance between government, nonprofit, and the private sector. And I kind of thought to myself, I was like, well, yeah, I would word it a little differently, but I don't totally disagree with that. And of course, and then he says, you know, I worked in the healthcare business. This is something that John Delaney said. He said, I worked in the healthcare business for quite some time. And then Senator Sanders says, it's not a business, of course. And then, you know, that's the debate right there, is that Bernie Sanders wants to completely and totally abolish healthcare as a business, any sort of profit incentive, any sort of entrepreneurialism, any sort of business mindset. And John Delaney actually has some form of moderation or some form of decency. So actually, let's play some clip right now. Let's play some sound of John Delaney just being a decent American. Can we play some clip of John Delaney saying some things that honestly should not be that controversial?
Folks, we have a choice. We can go down the road that Senator Sanders and Senator Warren want to take us with bad policies like Medicare for all, free everything, and impossible promises that'll turn off independent voters. Listen, his math is wrong. That's all I'm saying. If his math is wrong, it's been well documented that if all the bills were paid at Medicare rate, which is specifically, I think it's in Section 1200 of their bill, then many hospitals in this country would close. So I think Democrats win when we run on real solutions, not impossible promises. When we run on things that are workable, not fairy tale economics. So the bill that Senator Sanders drafted, by definition, will lower quality in healthcare. I'm the only one on the stage who actually has experience in the healthcare business. And with all due respect, I don't think my colleagues understand the business.
And so here's the divide, though, is that when Donald Trump won the 2016 election, He largely did so in a surprise fashion because no one thought that the base of the Democrat Party could be stolen from them. I mean, it was so profound and it was so historic and it was so out of nowhere. It would be as if in 2020, evangelicals all of a sudden go and vote for the Democrat. That is how just unprecedented it was what Donald Trump did in 2016. President Trump came out of nowhere and won the union workers and won Blue Dog Democrats and won centrists over in a way in Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, four states that he won, and he won them over in a way that no one saw possible. And so the Democrats have two totally distinct ways of how to address this deficit. They have two different ways of actually how to win back power, actually to win back the White House, if you will. You have the John Delaney, Congressman Ryan, and Governor Hickenlooper way, which is, hey, let's go win back our base. Let's actually stay towards the center and talk about things that actually make sense. I think Congressman Tim Ryan actually had one of the best lines of the entire debate, and he gets it. I think, you know, Mr. Producer, I think Congressman Tim Ryan listens to the Charlie Kirk Show. I think Congressman Tim Ryan was traveling to this debate, pop open Apple Podcasts, type in the Charlie Kirk Show, press subscribe, gave us 5 stars, left the review because he listened to How to Become President of the United States. I actually think he listened to it because you know what Congressman Tim Ryan said? He said, we need to become a party that talks to people that shower before work and after work.
Now, in this discussion already tonight, we've talked about taking private health insurance away from union members in the industrial Midwest. We've talked about decriminalizing the border. And we've talked about giving free health care to undocumented workers when so many Americans are struggling to pay for their health care. I, quite frankly, don't think that that is an agenda that we can move forward on and win. We've got to talk about the working class issues, the people that take a shower after work who haven't had a raise in 30 years. If we focus on them, we'll win the election.
Thank you, Congressman.
People that are working with their hands, they're sweating, they're carpenters, they're electricians, they're union workers, the backbone of our country, people that honestly Republicans have kind of turned their back on. People that traditional Republicans have kind of looked down to, the kind of snobbish elites have never thought to be in the same category, the metropolitan Rockefeller, Manhattan, and Malibu elites that have ruined our country so horribly over the last 30 or 40 years, don't consider to be part of one of their own. Congressman Tim Ryan was doing a direct and total messaging strategy towards these individuals. And you kind of saw that juxtaposed with Senator Bernie Sanders and Senator Elizabeth Warren. And Senator Elizabeth Warren had one of the most ridiculous statements of the entire debate. And no one is going to talk about it. So I'm going to pull out something that no one is going to talk about. And I'm going to tell you why it's ridiculous. So Senator Elizabeth Warren, and we'll play the clip in a second, she essentially was going back and refuting. There was this whole argument throughout the entire debate where Congressman Delaney was saying, well, we can't promise things limitlessly and we can't take things away from people. And then Senator Elizabeth Warren said, well, of course we can take things away from people. We can give people more things. And Senator Bernie Sanders said, no, we can give people more things on top of more things. And Senator Elizabeth Warren said, no, I can give more things than you can give. And essentially then eventually you saw Senator Elizabeth Warren and Senator Bernie Sanders kind of form this Marxist alliance, if you will, kind of to fight together against the somewhat moderate Blue Dog Democrats, the Bolsheviks versus the Blue Dogs. Remember, this is episode two, Revenge of the Moderates. Doesn't work out too well for them in the end, which kind of goes to our original thesis that we've been putting forth at the Charlie Kirk Show. And remember that Senator Elizabeth Warren and Senator Bernie Sanders, they are much more in the wing of the Democrat Party of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Rashida Tlaib and Ayanna Pressley and Ilhan Omar. That's where the energy, that's where the spirit, and that's where the enthusiasm of the Democrat Party is. So Senator Elizabeth Warren, she goes up and she says, she's refuting in one of these exchanges. She says, I can't believe that we're having a discussion of what we can't do and shouldn't fight for. In fact, let's play the sound right now so we get the specific sound.
You know, I don't understand why anybody goes to all the trouble of running for president of the United States just to talk about what we really can't do and shouldn't fight for.
So there you heard Senator Elizabeth Warren saying, we can't talk about what we can't do and shouldn't fight for. No, no, Senator Warren, that's exactly what you should be doing. It takes maturity, it takes restraint, and it takes courage to not use government in times of crisis. If government is always the answer to every single problem, you do not believe in the Scottish Enlightenment American model that has made America the greatest country in the history of the world. In fact, you should be talking about what you aren't going to do. You should be talking about what government programs you're going to eliminate, if not make more efficient. What parts of the government you might get rid of altogether. And so Senator Warren, her entire worldview as articulated in that sound is if you are not talking about growing government, you are somehow not sufficient to be part of the debate. This is such an important point. And I guarantee nobody else is going to tell you this because everyone's going to kind of go back to the kind of softball exchanges. But this right here has real substance and real philosophical meaning. Senator Elizabeth Warren basically considers you to be a flawed Democrat if you're not willing to dramatically and to drastically grow government. And not to mention, she got the loudest applause from that line. So let me all you kind of just give you some debate 101. Please, please take this. Applause means nothing. Applause means nothing in these debates. Do not dictate who does well and who does not well based on applause. Let me tell you why. President Donald Trump, back in many of the debates, was booed at the Republican debates. He was booed by the people that were attending the debates because the people who were attending the debates were the friends of all the other people on the debate stage that President Trump was insulting and going after. They were the donors of many of those people, and they were part of the ruling class. But what was most stunning is that the donors and the important people that were applauding, so I'm going to make one exception to my rule that applause means absolutely nothing. The one thing you could take away from actual Senator Elizabeth Warren saying this, she got roaring applause. So essentially the entire philosophical guiding premise of the Democrat Party is government is not doing nearly enough. Is that government needs to do much, much more. And then if you're talking about things that are realistic, like Congressman John Delaney was, forget about it. Don't even for a second touch on it. That you can't get anywhere near that. We have to talk about growing government. We have to talk about raising taxes. We have to talk about expanding the bureaucratic state. Because we as Democrats, that's what we stand for. We're statists and we're socialists. And if you dare get in our way, well, then you are not a true Democrat. I found that to be such an important and profound point. And so, and this is really important. They want the same government that runs the Veterans Administration and the DMV. The DMV being the Department of Motor Vehicles, which if you ever try to get a license recently, something I've been through because I moved my residency to Florida. 0% income tax, by the way, I highly recommend it. They want the DMV and the VA to take over more of your life. The inefficient, bureaucratic, nonsensical parts of our society, they want to only expand and grow that. You know, not once did I hear a Democrat, even a common sense Democrat like Congressman Tim Ryan and John Delaney, say something of the sort of, you know, maybe we can cut waste, fraud, and abuse. You know, that used to actually be a huge part of the Democrat platform. In fact, let's pull some sound right now of then Senator Obama running for the presidency, talking about how he's going to make government run more efficiently.
That starts with the painstaking work of examining every program, every entitlement, every dollar of government spending, and asking ourselves, is this program really essential? Are taxpayers getting their money's worth? Can we accomplish our goals more efficiently or effectively some other way? It's a process we've already begun, scouring our budget line by line for programs that don't work so we can cut them to make room for ones that do. That means ending tax breaks for companies shipping jobs overseas, stopping the fraud and abuse in our Medicare program.
There you had it. That was a Democrat who actually said that fraud and abuse and, you know, waste should actually be cut out of the budget. I didn't hear any of that. Instead, I had a discussion of who can give away the most amount of stuff. Now, again, you had John Delaney and Tim Ryan and Governor Bullock and Governor Hickenlooper clash with the radicals because they said, wait a second. Yeah, Medicare for All, you're going to take away 180 million people's health insurance? Yeah, I don't think so. And what was amazing is when they were cross-examined, when they were actually asked about it, they dug, Senator Sanders and Senator Warren dug in. They dug in and they said, no, we totally and completely agree with this, that we have to have a fundamental revolution, a fundamental change when it comes to healthcare. And their entire premise and their entire solution to health insurance is not to fix the private markets, not to allow more competition, but to instead have some sort of VA DMV nationalization takeover. And we have to remember, the government already runs a lot of parts in healthcare. We talked about the VA. Vets are dying waiting for care. Care is of super low quality. There's unbelievable, rampant, and massive corruption. Hospitals are shutting down. This is the Democrats' dream healthcare program. I mean, Bolshevik Bernie Sanders or Breadline Bernie Sanders, we still have a poll going. Do you like Bolshevik or Breadline Bernie Sanders, is pushing the myth of Canadian healthcare again. He says, oh, in Canada, it is so much better. He says, facts. What? This is some facts, okay? 1 million Canadians had to wait weeks for healthcare last year. 1 million Canadians. And they have far less people than we have in our country. Patients forfeited, people in Canada forfeited $1,800 in lost wages by waiting for healthcare. Wait times increased 377% under socialized medicine. Senator Sanders and Senator Warren are wrong. This sounds like a really good, like it's really nice sounding soundbite. This sounds like something you want to engage in. But again, to go back to Senator Warren and what she said, if you dare not want to grow government, you talk about what you shouldn't do. Oh, well, then you're not a true Democrat. Well, guess what? I want a politician like Senator Rand Paul, like Senator Ted Cruz, and President Donald Trump, who has the maturity and the restraint, the professionalism and the trust of the American people, to look at them in the eyes and say, I'm not going to grow government to fix this portion of broken American society. Instead, I'm going to increase opportunity. I'm going to lower taxes. How refreshing that would be to hear instead. Well, big problems, bigger government. Big problems, much bigger government, and that is the ethos of the Democrat Party. It goes back to what we've talked about in the Charlie Kirk Show, which is that people on the center right and people in the center, actually all Americans should really believe this, believes in one nation under God, when the left believes in one nation under government. Democrats are trying to kick 160 to 180 million Americans off their health insurance plans by eliminating private insurance. And yet they're the this is so funny. Yet they're the ones claiming Republicans want to take away your health care. It's absolutely stunning. But kind of going back to this idea of one nation under God, I want to go to one thing that really, really bothered me. And Pete Buttigieg, he goes out of his way to try to win over conservatives on things that conservatives have always talked about, whether it be the value of hard work or Midwestern values or religion. And so I think this was the worst place he probably could have put it, would you say, Mr. Producer? Yeah, it didn't make a lot of sense. And so Pete Buttigieg, Mayor Buttigieg, was talking about minimum wage, and out of nowhere he cites the Bible and how he cares about poor people. Let's play the sound.
Some of this is low tech too. Like, the minimum wage is just too low. And so-called conservative Christian senators right now in the Senate are blocking a bill to raise the minimum wage when scripture says that whoever oppresses the poor taunts their maker.
there's Mayor Pete saying so-called Christian senators. And look, kind of one of the core tenets of Christianity, again, it is biblical, but it's also just kind of an unspoken rule, is like, don't criticize other Christians' faith. Like, it's just not a, I mean, I'm an evangelical Christian. It's a most important thing in my life. For those of you that are not Christians and those of you who are not followers of the Bible, I highly encourage you to do that. It'll change your life. It'll change your worldview. It'll change everything that you do. You'll operate with more grace and more patience and more love of the world. I'm trying to be precise in the way I say this. I don't know what compelled him to say so-called Christian senators. I mean, that's a lot of venom to say that. There's a lot of venom just to say that. It just really disappoints me to hear him say that. But then he's trying to make a biblical argument for raising the minimum wage. And so we're going to do an entire show on the minimum wage soon and kind of debunking all the myths around the minimum wage. But kind of let me just start with saying this, which is, first and foremost, the minimum wage, as the minimum wage increases, prices also increase. And so we saw in New York recently, that actually raised the minimum wage. We have seen the data. We have actually seen what happens when the minimum wage is increased. And the results are not that good. In fact, I was on Martha McCallum's show recently on Fox News, and Martha McCallum is a dear friend, actually talking about this. Let's play some sound of me on Martha McCallum talking about the minimum wage.
The numbers, when you actually look at raising minimum wage, it might feel good and sound good, but really we've seen what happened in New York City. 75% of restaurants have had to cut hours and cut back staff because of a raise in the minimum wage. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that 3.7 million jobs would be lost if the federal minimum wage went up to $15 an hour, let alone $20 an hour. And not to mention, prices just go up. It's the consumer that ends up having to pay more, and then it's the middle class and lower class workers, entry-level positions, that get cut when you raise the minimum wage. And it's a burden on the middle class and the lower middle class workers.
And so as you heard there, I kind of touched on the surface there, but let me just give you this one very specific example, and this should hopefully dispel it. But before I do that, I just want to say, Mayor Pete, I'm really disappointed that you continue to use and misuse scripture to justify bigger government, more government control, and more centralized economic planning. Not only is it bad economics, not only is it poor political pandering, but it actually does a disservice to the people that you want to help most. And so if you'll bear with me for 1 second, I'm going to do the best I can, because this is a mostly visual example, but I'm going to do the best I possibly can to articulate this using audio for those of you listening on The Charlie Kirk Show. And please give us 5 stars and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. We so greatly appreciate it. So let's say I run Charlie's Burger Bar. It's a burger bar, and I have about 20 employees, and most of which are teenagers that are entry-level employees, and I have a manager. Let's say that I have employee A, I have employee B, and I have employee C. Employee A flips about 5 burgers an hour. Employee B flips 10 burgers an hour. Employee C flips 15 burgers an hour. They're all entry-level employees, and they're all earning the same. So they're all earning, let's say, $8 an hour, but their productivity is much different. But despite the differences in their productivity, they're earning the same because they're entry-level employees. So let's say the minimum wage was raised arbitrarily to $15 an hour that Mayor Pete Buttigieg uses the Bible to justify. Who's the first person that I fire? Who's the first person I let go? Because I have to raise the wage. By law, I have to increase costs. So I'm going to increase the cost of the burger, which is, who's buying burgers? Well, everyday Americans are buying burgers. You know, it's not like increasing the price of private jet fuel, or it's not like it's increasing the price of yachts. It's not like a highly specialized item that the millionaires and billionaires are buying. If I'm going to increase the cost of burgers, it's going to hit everyday Americans. But also, if I need to cut costs, which if we actually look at the data, we look what happens when the minimum wage is actually raised, costs are cut and prices go up. Well, who's the person I fire? Well, I fire employee A. And when you fire employee A, who is employee A usually? Well, employee A is typically the person with the least amount of skill, the person who needs the job the most, because employee C, who's flipping 15 burgers an hour, he's probably going to get a promotion anyway. So employee A, who needs the job, who's trying to get the skills to get to advance in life, the person who's actually trying to get some wherewithal to get some entry-level experience, they get fired, what happens? What happens to them? They probably go on government assistance, or they get in some other negative cycle. And so when you increase the minimum wage, and economist Thomas Sowell is like the best on this. Economist Thomas Sowell is off the charts the best. But when you increase the minimum wage, you actually end up disenfranchising the very community that you try to help. Are you saying you're help? Are you using the scripture to say that you're trying to help? Raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour, you heard these statistics earlier, would kill up to 3.7 million jobs, according to the Congressional Budget Office. I just want to reiterate this. Raising servers' minimum wage in New York City led to 75% of restaurants cutting their hours, so they're working less. And the average low-wage worker, when wages were hiked to $15 an hour, actually lost $125 a month on average due to decreased working time. And so, look, the studies are in. We've seen so many cities and municipalities and states raise the minimum wage. All it does is contribute to inflation. Inflation is a tax on the lower and middle class. Do you know what happens when there's inflation for rich people? Their assets just get worth more. Do you know inflation basically only helps the top 10% of people? And so when you have inflation and you have cheap money, people that are asset holders, people that own houses and people that own fossil fuels in the ground, or people that own stocks and people that own securities, they get a lot wealthier. And so what is a huge contributor to inflation? Well, arbitrary wage hikes, such as raising the minimum wage. It hurts the most vulnerable workers. Would you say the people that actually need the help the most? The people that Mayor Pete Buttigieg actually says that he wants to help. All right, before we continue with the Blue Dogs versus the Bolsheviks, the revenge of the moderates and the fight for the soul of the Democrat Party, if it even has a soul anymore, I need to tell you about something that all of you need to get right now. And I know a lot of young men listen to this program. And look, if you're going to be a man, you just got to have this piece of equipment. And what is that? It's Vincero watches. These stuff are so sleek. I see Mr. Producer walking around with his Vincero watch. I kid you not. We were in Washington, D.C. at our Turning Point USA Teenage Student Action Summit. I said, boy, that's a nice new watch. And he said, yeah, it's Vincero watches. I was listening to your show and I ordered it. And that's actually what happened. I mean, this stuff is really great. Vincero watches, they create exceptionally crafted watches and they sell them at a totally fair price. This is right within your price point. They're so sleek. I said, Mr. Producer, that is such a nice watch. And so guess what? I have a Vincero watch. It just came today in the mail. It is stunning. You got to check these out. They're focused on meticulous quality control and small batch manufacturing. Vincero has established themselves at the best value in the industry. You're not going to find a better made watch for this good of a price anywhere else. There's a reason why Vincero has 16,000. I mean, this is unbelievable. 16,000 five-star reviews, because their bold timepieces masterfully blend form and function into one affordable timepiece. Just for my listeners, Vincero is offering 15% off your entire order with the code KIRK, K-I-R-K. Just head to VinceroWatches.com and use the code KIRK for 15% off. Look, this whether you're working out, whether you are on the move a lot, you need a watch, especially young men out there. You need, be a man. You got to buy a watch. It's free worldwide shipping, has 16,000 five-star reviews. And again, it's V-I-N-C-E-R-O, watches.com. That's again, that's V-I-N-C-E-R-O, watches.com. Use the code KIRK. I'm literally giving you money, 15% off your entire order. And guess what? For the young ladies out there that are listening to this podcast, you can also get this for your father, for your uncle, for your niece, for your nephew, if you're an aunt, or you can get it for your brother, you can get it for your boyfriend. Everyone listening to this podcast has a reason to go buy a Vincero watch. VinceroWatches.com, V-I-N-C-E-R-O, watches.com. Use the code KIRK, 15% off your whole order. They've had styles sell out before. So before you go pick it out, your favorite accessory, you will not be disappointed, and use the code KIRK for 15% off. All right, welcome back to our analysis of the Blue Dogs versus the Bolsheviks. And so one of the most telling moments of the entire debate, and again, this is not going to get too much coverage, maybe our good friend Tucker Carlson at Fox News might cover it, is when Senator Bernie Sanders talked about how he wants to decriminalize crossing border crossings into the country. And let's play the clip. But he also mentioned something that is just so stunning, where he wants to unite the hemisphere together. And so the Democrats are finally admitting it. They want to make America Nicaragua, or they want to make Nicaragua America. I mean, you could kind of figure out which one that is. And they essentially want the total and complete erosion of sovereignty and borders in our country. They're no longer shy about it. They want a seamless and totally united North America. Let's listen to Senator Sanders.
We got to ask ourselves, why are people walking 2,000 miles to a strange country where they don't know the language? So what we will do the first week we are in the White House is bring the entire hemisphere together to talk about how we rebuild Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador so people do not have to flee their own countries.
And so there was Senator Sanders kind of going off on some weird pandering tangent. And again, so Senator Sanders is going against kind of what he built his whole career on. Senator Sanders used to be a lot more like Congressman Tim Ryan, where he criticized really bad trade deals, where he was actually really strict on illegal immigration. Senator Sanders used to be an immigration hawk, talking about hardworking men and women and the Rust Belt and the inner cities. Senator Sanders has now changed his entire view and has decided, instead of trying to win back the hardworking people in our country, he wants to try to pander to lawless, border-jumping non-citizens who came into our country illegally, try to get their votes and the people that they know's votes, and that should now be the base of the Democrat Party. It's a total shift from where Senator Sanders used to be. And you had Congressman Tim Ryan, who's like, well, no, we need more border security. And Congressman Tim Ryan and former Congressman John Delaney said, well, no, we actually need some form of border enforcement. And John Delaney actually said something along the lines of impossible promises. That's what happened with McGovern, Mondale, and Dukakis. Oh my goodness, I'm actually convinced that Congressman Tim Ryan and Congressman John Delaney were both listening to the Charlie Kirk Show at once, because this is exactly what we covered last week. Let's listen to Congressman John Delaney talk about impossible promises.
Folks, we have a choice. We can go down the road that Senator Sanders and Senator Warren want to take us with bad policies like Medicare for all, free everything, and impossible promises that'll turn off independent voters and get Trump reelected. That's what happened with McGovern. That's what happened with Mondale. That's what happened with Dukakis.
And Congressman John Delaney continued with the critique of the left and the critique of the radical left that we have been using on this show, where we say that the healthcare position that is espoused by the Democrat Party, the healthcare positions that is espoused by the Bolshevik wing of the Democrat Party, it's not actually about giving healthcare to people. It's about getting rid of private enterprise. And oh my goodness, he said it.
But the question is, why do we have to be so extreme? Why can't we just give everyone health care as a right and allow them to have choice?
Thank
I'm
you,
starting to think this is
so,
not about health care. This is an
anti-private
sector strategy.
We're going to move on to...
And so there you had Congressman Delaney essentially saying the argument that we've been making here on the Charlie Kirk Show and many people on the conservative side have been making, which is that this is not a conversation about health care. This is a conversation about the erosion of private property. And Congressman Tim Ryan made a really good point, which is that a lot of these unions have actually negotiated pretty good health care, and that's all they have left after the bad trade deals and middle class tax hikes that we've seen from the Kingdom of Washington, D.C. and the supposed wise men of Washington that have continued to enrich the coastal elites but disenfranchise middle America. All they really have left is this health care. And now you're telling them they have to get VA style Medicaid for all, not Medicare, but Medicaid for all style health care. I don't think so, says Congressman Tim Ryan. He pushes back forcefully, and he pushed back assertively on this. But minus one comment from Senator Amy Klobuchar, there was one massive thing missing from this debate. And so typically debates are built within the news cycle. Now, I'm going to say something here that no one else is going to say, and you're not going to hear this analysis anywhere else. Maybe the great Rush Limbaugh, maybe the great Mark Levin might say this. But did you notice two things that were noticeably absent from this debate, minus a short mention from Senator Amy Klobuchar and something else? Maybe somebody else might have mentioned it, I should say. No one defended Baltimore. I mean, Baltimore was the number one thing in the news cycle over the last 4 or 5 days. And typically these debates are a reaction to the last couple days of the news cycle, and how can I use those things in the news cycle to essentially destabilize Donald Trump or make Donald Trump see less fitting to be president. Did you notice that there is no grandstanding about Donald Trump's criticism of Baltimore? I find this amazingly fascinating, because every single person on that debate found time to tweet about it in the last couple days. but no one went up there and decided to sing the praises of Democrat monopolistic control in our inner cities. It's as if Donald Trump has actually struck a very meaningful chord when now that he's criticizing Reverend Al Sharpton, and now that he's criticizing the inner cities. This is really important, because if this was something that the Democrats were actually proud of, and they didn't actually use as a tactic to get retweets or as a tactic to try to attack the President of the United States, they would have went out of their way to say, Baltimore is a beautiful, brimming place. How dare our president attack? I didn't hear that. I heard Senator Amy Klobuchar say one thing about how President Trump said that Baltimore was infested with rats, which it is, by the way. And by the way, at Turning Point USA, Benny Johnson actually went to Baltimore and found a leaflet and a flyer of the Democrat City Council actually warning the citizens against massive rat infestation. I bet you haven't heard that on your nightly news. And you know what the other thing that wasn't mentioned that I found to be very fascinating, and again, maybe some of this will be mentioned tomorrow night, I doubt it, was there wasn't any sort of massive grandstanding in defense of the squad. That the moderates were deliberately out of the now new kind of caricatures of the Democrat Party. I thought there was going to be, and my guess was proven to be incorrect. I thought there was going to be a moment tonight where Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar and Ayanna Pressley got a shout out from some of the candidates, where they said, we will not stand with our president attacking the squad and whatever they, you know, the women of color, whatever sort of narrative that they try to push. I didn't hear it. I didn't say it. And I'm having Mr. Producer check through all the transcripts right now. I think this is a really important point, because the moderates obviously want nothing to do with it. But could it be that also Senator Elizabeth Warren and Senator Bernie Sanders might have seen some of the internal polling and know just how unpopular these women are and their radicalism and their ideas? Here's some wisdom for the squad. Never confuse popularity with importance. They're not the same thing. Just because you're popular does not mean you're important. And just because you're notorious does not mean you're wise. And I think it's very interesting that these seasoned politicians went totally out of their way to not mention them, because it took effort, because this was the main news cycle for the last couple days. For the last couple days, this was the main news cycle of, whoa, President Trump attacks the squad, President Trump attacks Baltimore, so on and so forth. And it was very interesting to see them intentionally avoid it. One other thing I want to mention, two other points that I want to mention on this debate, and I will, of course, I'm going to mention Marianne Williamson, you know, the new age author who wants to be president of the United States. But look, the debate descended into this competition of who can give away the most amount of stuff, only took a period of time. And I don't think a moderate actually got asked about reparations, which, again, I think reparations and the conversation about reparations is one of the most dangerous and one of the most flawed policy discussions that we can have as a civil society. I think if we start to get into a pattern, we start to get into this endless cycle, I should say, of us looking back 150 years, and if you're a descendant of someone, of something, if something horrible and immoral and bad happened to you, you then should receive other people's money, even though the people that are living had nothing to do with it. So this is all kind of rooted on this very flawed argument that the systems in this country are based on intergenerational wealth and intergenerational wealth accumulation that was based on systemic racism and systemic pillaging and plundering of the Black and African American community. This has been debunked so many times. It's been debunked by Thomas Sowell. It's been debunked by multiple economists, and it's nothing more than a blatant and total pandering of to try to get votes. And so Robert Francis O'Rourke, who calls himself Beto, the Irishman from El Paso, Texas, he says that he wants to put forth the slavery and reparations bill. And look, this is really important. The Democrats are obsessed with awarding victimology rather than lifting up victors, which is the real American dream. The real American story is not about who can give out the most stuff. The American story is not who can give out the most amount of other people's items to another victimized group. And I'm not diminishing slavery whatsoever. I'm not trying to say it never existed, nor am I not trying to say it was horrific. In fact, I will say this on the Charlie Kirk Show. Anyone who owns slaves, anyone who participated in the slave trade should go to jail now. Anyone who participates in slavery should go to jail now. In fact, anyone who knew anyone who owned slaves and supported it should go to jail now. Can anyone find me anyone? No, because we're 2, 3, 4, 5 generations removed from it. So yes, I do believe in reparations. If somebody was alive right now that owned slaves, they should relinquish everything that they had. Nothing. And look, I'm very fearful of this argument for a variety of different ways. First of all, let's just talk about how insane this is. What if someone is half white, half black? Do they pay money to themselves? I mean, how does that one work? Or what about someone who's a first-generation immigrant? What about someone who's a first-generation immigrant from Peru? And they just get naturalized. They have a very, let's say they have a successful tech startup in Atlanta, Georgia. They employ 8 people. They now have to pay taxes towards reparations to a country that their people didn't live in. This is nothing more than shameless pandering to try to get votes. And I was actually really disappointed in the moderates that I've been building up this entire episode at their silence. I'm very disappointed that John Delaney and that Congressman Tim Ryan didn't just interject and say, wait a second, reparations? We have entire communities that are of all different colors. But yes, we have communities that are also white, that have high opioid epidemics, that have huge unemployment numbers, that are suffering from depression and suicide. And we're having a conversation of how we can tax these communities so that we can give money to communities that multiple generations ago, something horrible happened to them. Again, I'm not cheapening the horrific tragedy of slavery in our country. And again, Beto and then Robert Francis O'Rourke doubled down on this shameless idea that America, let's just play this clip, please, that America's built on racism and systems of oppression. Play clip.
I want to acknowledge something that we're all touching on, which is the very foundation of this country. The wealth that we have built, the way we became the greatest country on the face of the planet, was literally on the backs of those who were kidnapped and brought here by force. The legacy of slavery and segregation and Jim Crow and suppression is alive and well in every aspect of the economy and in the country today.
Again, you know where he gets this from? This is straight from the university. This is an idea so foolish and so vapid that only a university professor could possibly believe this. I mean, anyone who has existed in the real world, anyone who has existed in the highest levels of business, or even through any sort of travel of the country, who hasn't been isolated in the halls of Washington or confined to the ivory towers of academia like Robert Francis O'Rourke has, he's been told America's a racist country, even though you go walk the streets of New York, go to Brooklyn, go to the Bronx, go look at the amazing small businesses that are owned of people of all different races and creeds and backgrounds and religions and Muslims and Jews and Christians and atheists and secularists, people from all different backgrounds, and you're trying to tell me that you can't succeed in this country if you don't have good ideas and you don't work hard. Yet he's focused on this flawed idea that America is systemically built on institutional racism. If that was possibly the case, why is it that Asians in this country are the richest per capita, have the highest wealth per capita, have the highest income per capita, are the most likely to go to college, commit the least amount of crimes, and have the safest neighborhoods? Well, maybe it's because Asian Americans value education very highly. They graduate high school in high numbers. They have very low divorce rates. They get married before they have kids, and they all work in their society. Maybe we could take a page out of that book. You know, in the 1860s and 70s, a form of slavery, which essentially was oppressed labor, 10,000 plus Chinese came to this country and helped build the Transcontinental Railroad. I mean, there have been forms of racism against many different types of groups, including Jewish Americans, including Irish Americans. If we start to get into the victimology oppression Olympics, we're never going to run out of people to give money to. Instead, why don't we focus on something America has always stood for, which is to be a beacon of opportunity, not a beacon of redistributive oppression Olympics. My goodness, Robert F. Francis O'Rourke. I mean, you must really want to be president. I don't want to be anything as much as you want to be president. I mean, because for you to believe this and for you to profess this, boy, you want power, my friend. You want power so bad you are willing to push forth such dangerous lies that pander to broken communities and are looking for answers, and you're giving them something that honestly will only further divide the entire core of our country. And so now I have to talk about it, which is the front page of Drudge, which is Marianne Williamson, the new age author, if you will. I'm going to talk in a very soothing voice now. Take a very deep breath. In with the nose and out with the mouth. I hope your candles are lit and your yes, that's right, Mr. Producer. Play the sitar music. Just play da-da-da-da. That's right. Everyone, breathe. That's right. Marianne Williamson, the spiritual new age author, said that President Donald Trump, there's a spiritual problem in America. I'm going to pull up the exact quote right here. Oh, yes, that's right. Marianne Williamson said that there's a psychotic force at work in America towards Donald Trump. Play clip.
And the entire conversation that we're having here tonight, if you think any of this wonkiness is going to deal with this dark psychic force of the collectivized hatred that this president is bringing up in this country, then I'm afraid that the Democrats are going to see some very dark days. We need to say it like it is. It's bigger than Flint. It's all over this country. It's particularly people of color. It's particularly people who do not have the money to fight back. And if the Democrats don't start saying it, then why would those people feel that they're there for us? And if those people don't feel it, they won't vote for us. And Donald Trump will win.
Now, the Drudge poll actually has Marianne M. Williamson winning. Okay, a lot of people are saying this. I can't tell who's trolling and who's not. I don't think she was particularly good. That's just my take. Maybe if New Age authorship is your thing, then okay. But Marianne M. Williamson is talking, I just can't do anything but kind of laugh at this. Because I guess this resonates with some people. You know, I kind of find the more kind of out there you are, the more committed your following is, which is obviously how she made it the debate stage, because she was able to raise an extraordinary amount of money. She did, however, say something I completely and totally agree with, which she said that dark days for Democrats are ahead if the current trajectory continues. And she actually was saying, she was actually talking about how if things continue the way they are, Republicans are only going to kind of categorize them in a certain way. And that's exactly right. And she said, I do have some concern about what Republicans will say, end quote. And remember in the first debate, let's actually play her quote from the first debate where she said that love and unity will defeat Donald Trump. Let's play that famous clip from Marianne M. Williamson from the first debate.
I have an idea about Donald Trump. Donald Trump is not going to be beaten just by insider politics talk. He's not going to be beaten just by somebody who has plans. He's going to be beaten by somebody who has an idea what this man has done. This man has reached into the psyche of the American people, and he has harnessed fear for political purposes. So, Mr. President, if you're listening, I want you to hear me, please. You have harnessed fear for political purposes, and only love can cast that out. So I have a feeling you know what you're doing. I'm going to harness love for political purposes. I will meet you on that field, and sir, love will win.
So this is going totally viral. I really don't have much of an analysis here, except that she does offer at times some kind of sober wisdom. You know, she's Marianne Williamson's kind of that person in the back of the library that while you're studying kind of comes up to you all the time, and like 1 out of 100 times she says something like ridiculously wise. And then it kind of hits you a couple days later. You're like, oh, yeah, that crazy woman at the library mentioned that. And you kind of go back and she's buried in all these books. And then you go back to find her and she's gone. And you ask the librarian, hey, whatever happened to that woman back there? And they have no idea who you're talking about. It was like a figment of the imagination. Yeah, it feels like some sort of Goonies movie or something. But Marianne Williamson is, she says some things that are really, really wise. I don't know, intentionally or unintentionally. I mean, she's obviously not a dummy. She's a best-selling author, so she can produce a lot of content quickly. A lot of people are saying she won the debate. I wouldn't go that far. I think John Delaney was the big winner, maybe because I love America more than I love my party, and I actually want moderate voice in the Democrat Party to long-term succeed because I want America to succeed. Go figure. I love this country tremendously, and I actually want to see this country succeed. And I think if John Delaney ended up winning the presidency, the country actually wouldn't go into total deconstruction mode. And so she said something. This is a direct quote from Marianne Williamson. She said, I do have concern about what the Republicans would say, and that's just not a Republican talking point. I do have concern that will be difficult. I have concern it'll make it harder to win, and I have concern it'll make it harder to govern. She's talking about the labels that Republicans would throw on these crazy radical Democrat policies. And so Marianne Williamson, you're called the winner of the debate. I don't see it. I call this, who won the debate? I actually think the moderates won the night. The entire conversation was actually really sobered up. It was talking about the cost and the realistic implications of some of these radical ideas. Pete Buttigieg, I think, was the big loser. He said some things that were just so out there and just was I think trying to split the middle between the Bolsheviks and the Blue Dogs, and he just came across as very weak. He didn't have a clear and concise message, and he kept referencing himself as mayor, and everyone knows he's a completely and totally failed mayor in South Bend. I don't think Pete Buttigieg was a big winner whatsoever. I think he was the biggest loser of the debate. In fact, but he did say something I totally agree with. He said, "Yes, I would end the war in Afghanistan. Good for you, Pete Buttigieg. The chance of you falling through on it would be very little to nothing because you're never going to be president of the United States. However, good for you for actually saying that you would end the endless wars." When a Democrat says something wise, they should be called out for it, and a stop clock is right twice a day. So kind of in closing here, you kind of saw the Democrats fight for the soul of the Democrat Party. You saw themselves look at the mirror and they asked themselves, who are we? Are we the party, as Tim Ryan said, of the worker that showers before work and after work? Are we the party of the border jumper, the lawlessness? Are we the party, the Malibu and the Manhattan elite that cater to ideas and values and a worldview that really is not American in nature? And what I found really interesting is that a lot of the opening statements were actually generally conservative in nature, talking about hard work. Marianne Williamson, of all people, actually talked about our great founding in 1776. I thought the Democrat Party hated the American founding, so that was kind of refreshing to hear someone say something nice about America. However, the winner were the moderates. But that is no guarantee that the moderates are going to win this Democrat primary debate. The energy, the enthusiasm, the dollars in the crowds are behind the candidates like Warren, like Harris, and like Sanders. Biden might be up in the polls, but boy, I'll tell you what, being up in the polls this far ahead of time, it feels and sounds like Jeb Bush, feels and sounds like Ted Cruz, feels and sounds like Marco Rubio. This is not the time when you want to be surging in the polls at all whatsoever. I'll tell you what matters. Crowd size absolutely does matter. Small dollar donations absolutely does matter. Amount of volunteers matters. Social media chatter matters. And your ability to dictate the terms of the policy discussion totally and completely matters. So we're going to be back tomorrow with another episode of the Charlie Kirk Show when we watch Biden go against Harris round two. We see if Andrew Yang is going to get more than 180 seconds to talk about his foolish idea to give a bunch of money away to people. Who else is tomorrow? Well, let's see. Who am I missing? Well, we had all the moderates tonight, which means all the radicals are going to be tomorrow. Let me think. We have Harris. We have Biden. We have a bunch of other forgettable candidates tomorrow. But nevertheless, we're going to be there watching it, so you don't have to. We're going to be doing instant analysis, which will be posted the morning after. And right now, please do me a favor. Support our sponsors. Support Vincero, support Simply Safe, but also please give us that 5-star rating. Go to Apple Podcast or your podcast delivery system, press subscribe, leave a review. We totally and greatly appreciate it. And also those of you that are following Turning Point USA, please go to tpusa.com, support us however you can, leave a donation, get engaged, get involved. If you're a student listening to this, please go start a Turning Point USA chapter. You are the backbone of our country. You are the future of our country. If you're an adult listening to this, please go to tpusa.com, support us in any way you can, and get your kids engaged and involved. Get one other person to listen to the show, leave a comment, give us 5 stars, hit subscribe, press subscribe. It really helps us out. This is Charlie Kirk signing off from the Charlie Kirk Show. I watch the Democrat debate, so you don't have to. Will it be the Blue Dogs versus the Bolsheviks, or will it be Biden versus Harris round two? We'll see. Again, give us that subscribe. We greatly and totally appreciate it.
Hey, everybody, it's Laura Ingraham, and I'd like to invite you to check out my new show, The Laura Ingraham Podcast, exclusively on Podcast One. So join me 3 days a week as I cover politics, the culture, everything in between, laugh, learn, all at the same time. We got you locked and loaded, and you'll be ready for the week, ready for the month, and it's very easy. You just subscribe today, download new episodes exclusively at podcastone.com or wherever you find your favorite podcast, and you know mine's going to be one of your newest podcasts.